You are listening to How Do We Make It Better, the podcast where we explore how people in nonprofits, corporations, social enterprises, politics, and other walks of life try to make it better. Get this where all quality podcasts are found. Links to all those places are at bit.ly/How Do We Make It Better Podcast, or if that's too long, bit.ly/HDWMIB. You can also check us out at dougabdiel.com. That's dougabdiel.com. First, I need to apologize a bit for the intermittent interjections of my daughter, Eden. She's teething, and the weather outside was a bit too bad for her to head out. So no matter how many doors I put between us and her, you might hear her a bit in the background. So apologies, but she's very cute, so I say that in my defense. Second thing, and more pertinent to this interview, I really struggled during this interview. I think I struggled in part because of my own expectations. Dan talks a lot about dialogue, conversation, listening, civilized debates, these kinds of things. And as much as I hoped that I could help bring out across the aisle dialogue, I found myself wanting Dan to take a partisan position on things or even declare his own political party, which he doesn't mention at any point in the interview. And I challenge you, if by the end, to figure out what you think his political party actually is. My expectations were, as I said, those were the problem, on the way in, that he would take a fiery stance on something. And it was kind of ironic that I was disappointed about this, given that I'm trying to encourage these kinds of civilized dialogues myself. Imagine what a new nonpartisan politician would look like. Because if we don't have that image in our heads, then it's very difficult for anybody to fulfill that, right? One way that that could look is what Dan looks like. But again, in order for that to come about, we have to be able to imagine that. What if the shape of a new politician was someone who cared deeply about method, cared deeply about dialogue, conversations, meaningful ones with his constituents and with his colleagues? I guess what I'm asking you to imagine is what you would really want in a politician who doesn't take extreme positions and defend them to the hilt, who doesn't continually refer to the party across the aisle as the problem. This is not an exclusively American problem. If you listen to anybody here in Australia, they will tell you that every bad thing that has ever happened in the world is a result of the last government, if they're in power, or the government that's currently in power, if they're out of power. I'm asking you to consider, what if Dan really means what he says? What if we really had a series of similarly disposed people in Congress and indeed in society? If you don't think that's better, then fine, but don't let your own failure of imagination prevent you from finding a way to make it better. Here's my interview with Dan Helmer, a veteran of Iraq and Afghanistan, captain in the U.S. Army, Rhodes Scholar, father, and candidate for Virginia's 10th Congressional District. Dan, I just want to thank you for taking the time to come out today and have a chat. Today, as I already said in the intro, I'm really excited to have a chat with Dan. He's got a very eclectic and interesting and diverse background, lots of bits that I can relate to and some that I can't. The one that I can't quite relate to is why you would go out and try and make the world a better place through running through for Congress. So I'm just going to turn the mic over to you for a bit, Dan, to just give us a bit of an intro about yourself, about your time in the military, your education, family, whatever you want to talk about to give people a fuller picture of who you are.
Sure. Thanks for doing that, Doug. My wife and I watched the election, this past election, with surprise at the tenor of the election and increasingly alarm as it became clear after the election that particularly this administration was going to govern in the same way that it had campaigned. And, you know, we looked at each other on January 20th, watching the inauguration speech of the president, one in which it surfaced a lot of ideas that come from a part of our history that is not our finest moment. And I'm the son of immigrants and the grandson of Holocaust survivors. My family came here as immigrants and refugees. And in this country, they found prosperity, freedom, and peace. And that's an American dream that belongs to all of us. And knowing that growing up, it caused me to want to serve my country. And it's why I went to West Point. It's why I served in the military. And I think that it's one that belongs to all of us. It's a dream that belongs to all of us. And I want to make sure that for my children and my grandchildren, and for all Americans, they have a shot at that, that we protect ourselves as a country from the worst excesses of our politics, from the depolarization that's taken root, and that we work collectively to find new solutions and bring new leadership to some institutions that have become ossified, that have ceased working, and that have caused Americans to break trust with their government.
Wow. Don't set out too difficult a task for yourself to start off, Daniel Gao. Look, there's a huge amount in there, hyper-partisanship, a bit of sclerosis in the institutions that we're talking about. Out of those things, like if you were to stack rank the things that you're most passionate about making a difference about coming to Congress, which of those things would you think is kind of the primary issue?
Yeah, I think actually it is the issue. The issue is that government, our government, has stopped working for America. And the response to that has been to put some people in office that want to tear the whole thing down and don't care much about the direction that we go. And I think we need to move beyond that, because it's important as Americans and patriots that we have a functional government that provides the backbone in which we build our nation, in which we build our economy, in which we build our security. And to move beyond that, we really do have to reset it. We need government that provides oversight, that provides solutions, that passes laws that gain widespread support, that really functions, and that takes the best of what's on offer and makes us great innovators that lead the world in any number of areas. And I think we've had that. I think we can have that. And I don't think we can stand idly by while that goes away. And restoring a government that works again, it is the project that we need. And we need legislators in office who are leaders, who are problem solvers, and who aren't just going to accept the way that business gets done because that's the way it's kind of done for a few days.
Even in the way that you phrase these things, it's clearly not very partisan. It's very interesting to hear you say that, because in one sense, you're making quite a conservative argument that says, look, the institutions that we have are great. We don't want to tear them down, but we want to bring in words like innovation and do things a new way, which is not a very conservative argument. I mean, this is an interesting approach to trying. You're trying to use over 200-year-old institutions to do something very new, and trying to get institutions that kind of by design, the separation of powers and the bicameral legislature, are designed to move deliberatively and slowly to move a little bit faster.
Let me just pause for a second. I really like the word you use, deliberatively, though, right? So the problem is that our legislative bodies have stopped being places of deliberation and have become places for grandstanding. And we need deliberation and thoughtful problem solving. We need coalition building. We need to build bridges and not walls. And for too long, folks have seen, politicians, I'm not a politician, politicians who are in power believe that their only route to continuing to be in power is to find a poll in every issue. And there are some issues with deep polls where right and wrong is very clear. But there are lots of places where we can find new and innovative approaches that afford us a way to make progress for our country and ensure we continue to deliver on the values to which we aspire.
My hat's off to you for trying to. I have just the briefest of experience in Congress, working for as a fellow for Rob Portman years ago, and I commend you for trying to do that. My question to you, if I could get tactical on this a bit, is that those are wonderful aspirations, but we're almost in the just prior to Civil War era where we've got congressmen caning one another on the floor of Congress. It is the level of discourse that we've got. How do you bring those back together? Like, what tactically is your plan? I see the need, and I think a lot of others would see the need for reasonable dialogue, but how are you planning to do it?
Yeah, so I can't do it alone. I am encouraged. The organization that encouraged me to run in this race and brought me in is one called New Politics. It's run by a woman named Emily Cherniak. She's amazing. And Emily believes that by getting a critical mass of dedicated public servants to public office, we can reset our politics. We need servant leaders, and we need a critical mass of them. I'm but one, but by having folks like me and others similar to me elected into public office, and specifically by getting a critical mass of similar legislators, we can reset the conversation in Congress. And so the tactic is to win and encourage others like me to run and to build a mass of people who stand first for country and first for ideas that will move our country forward and who are willing to base policy and our discussion in reason and fact and allow for reasonable disagreement at the same time that doesn't cause paralysis.
Wow. Again, it's an extraordinarily set of noble goals. But take even the example that you used of facts, right? We have, for the first time in my life, started talking about alternative facts, right? As though that's actually a thing. And how do you, when, for instance, you have a committee meeting that is aired on C-SPAN, broadcast to the nation, where somebody wants to get up and grandstand and just make their point and doesn't actually intend to ask any questions of the interviewees who are sitting there, how do you inject civility into that dialogue?
So, Doug, I don't know that you can inject civility every single time, but it starts with our own behavior, right? So by being civil, by being truthful, by not being a politician, by not swaying with the winds, you can establish yourself as a credible. You can establish yourself as a person who bases what they say in facts. And so excessive honesty is what people have not come to expect from their politics. And yet, I'm a person who lives by an honor code and lives by an honor code and making sure that we have people who tell truth, who are willing to admit when they were wrong, who are willing to seek facts, and are willing to change when they see that the facts point in a different direction. You're right. You can't make everybody do that at once, but you can start doing it in your own district and you can encourage other people to do it in their districts. And folks know that Americans are tired of politicians who are willing to say whatever it takes just to get elected. I'm willing to say whatever it takes for America to work for Americans, for our government to function. And I think that's the kind of leadership we need. And I hear you saying, look, Dan, these are aspirations. How do we get there? We get there by continuing to elect more and more folks like me because more and more Americans are just frustrated and tired. And I think there is an audience. There is an audience and an electorate for reasonable people, for people who are going to stand for our country, for patriots, who know that the direction our government is taking is bad for those who want to see a stronger America, a more inclusive America, and a more prosperous America for our children than the one we have today.
Wow. As I told you before we started this, I won't continue with all the questions that we started with. Let's take that excessive honesty line. Can you give me an example of a time in your life, it can be in politics, cannot be, ideally a political issue, where you have had your own mind swayed, where you once took one position, you're like, oh, okay, I thought that was right. But then through dialogue and reasonable looking at the facts or whatever other method, you had your own mind swayed.
You know, it's really interesting. It's a great question. And I actually, I worked for the past 3 years prior to doing this full time for a large international strategic advisor. And it is a place. It is a place where literally every recommendation you make, every decision you look to is one in which you look at hard, cold facts and reason to decide. And so, for instance, I spent a large amount of time helping to reform a major government agency, very strategic level. And, you know, you would come in with a hypothesis. This is how I think we're going to make change. And oftentimes you would find that, you know, when you actually got down to looking at the root causes of things, they would be surprising and they would reset the ways in which you think about it. I mean, one of the things that we were looking at was purchasing done by the U.S. government. And what we found is oftentimes, you know, incentives that drive behavior were there that we were surprised about and that were driving good people away from making great decisions. And you would show them facts and they would respond to them. And sometimes you would find that, you know, what you thought was the cause of a bad negotiated deal or something like that was not the cause. It actually was rooted in something entirely different. So you saw the outcome, but not necessarily understand the causes, and it would cause you to shift. And that was, I mean, I'm having trouble giving you the specific instance because there were so many instances of it where you looked at something and you were like, oh, it wasn't exactly what I thought. There was something deeper than that or different than that. And it caused you to continue to evolve and continue to learn. And that's not shifting your position, by the way. That's being smart in response to the changes on the ground and changes in your understanding. It's about evolving our understanding and getting better and smarter. And it's about hearing the voices of many different people, hearing many different sets of ideas, And then looking for the signal where you can find it that, that drives you towards a good, meaningful answer.
Okay. I spent a little time in a strategy consulting firm myself. I can appreciate how quickly you have to adapt and overcome. What are the things that you saw in that experience that you think are easily transferable here? Obviously, you're working on a discrete project there, whereas here you've got the Congressional Budget Office and CRS out there to provide you a bit, and six really hardworking, dedicated staffers. For those who are not familiar with the way Congress works, there's a few folks who are really back behind carrying a huge amount of load trying to support these congressmen, but the amount of research that you're able to do is much lower than what you're able to do in a strategy consulting firm. You know, there's no amazing ability to offshore a lot of this thinking or test hypotheses. Do you think that we're set up institutionally, and do you think that you're set up institutionally to be able to handle serious informational ambiguity, gaps, and perhaps not being able to drill down to the level of data that you were able to drill down to in strategy consulting?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you operate at the level in which you can make decisions, right? One of the things that both of us come from the military, right? And I still am an active reservist. And one of the things that you learn to do is make decisions with incomplete and sometimes contradictory information. One of the best things about getting veterans elected to office is we come with a set of experiences where you have to deal with truly ambiguous situations. You have to build some form of consensus, and eventually you have to make a decision. And so I think a combination of the ability to sift through massive amounts of information and the ability to act decisively, and the ability to act decisively while bringing folks along with you, which is the essence of leadership, right? There was this view of the military where it's about you telling people what to do. But the fact that you have legal authority to tell somebody what to do isn't leading. Leading, you increasingly learn as an officer, is about finding ways in which to encourage people to act with. And that's the sort of problem solving and decision making and leadership that we lack today.
Look, I'm inspired. I'm not going to lie. Okay, let me ask you to put back on your strategy consulting hat for a second, and let's talk just simply about expected value calculations. Okay, for the uninformed, right? This is the probability of that an event is going to happen times its potential impact. That's one side, your cost, and then the same equation on the other side, probability that something is going to happen times its potential impact on the other side. Just weighing up probability impact.
I would be clear if my staff ever listens to this that you walked out long before I did.
No, that's fair. That's fair. But I think that
into this podcast.
No, I got it. That's fair. Look, I think part of raising the dialogue with the American public has to be not being scared of math a little bit. No, it's not too bad. Yes. Look, help me about understand your cost benefit calculation personally for pursuing this endeavor. I've spoken to somebody else who ran for Congress, didn't make it in, but said that, look, he never figured out what a bad person he was until he ran for Congress. And then all of a sudden people were telling him what a terrible individual he was, right? There's an emotional cost. There's a financial cost. There's a cost on your family, I'm sure, just to try to have the chance to be the one perhaps deciding vote in the occasional bill that comes to Congress that you might sway it one direction or not. I mean, because without getting even more wonky, the irrationality of voting hypothesis applies to a legislative body of several hundred members as well, where you have to end up with a binary decision off of a population of individuals. Help me walk through why any rational person would spend the amount of money that you're going to have to spend and sacrifice what you're trying to sacrifice to make a difference in this way versus, I don't know, continue to do strat consulting or continue to do something else.
So I hear the question, Doug, and I think to myself, there is no mathematical equation that tells you that when asked, you should find ways in which to serve. Because the reality is, as a patriot, as an American, as somebody who has been the beneficiary of a country that welcomed my family here, I've always asked myself, how can I serve? And this is clearly a time where we need new ideas and new leaders and a new way of doing business. And I don't know how I could say no. And when I was approached and asked, would I be willing to do this by New Politics? And when I recognized that I, not alone, but with the help of all the folks in this district and the help with other like-minded people who are going to run for office and going to change our politics in this country could be part of something bigger than myself. I couldn't say no to that.
I am reminded of that phrase, if not me, then who? If not now, then when? Look, I'm Jewish, by the way.
I really like that phrase.
I get that.
From a rabbi.
I didn't know that. I would love to put that in the original quote in the show notes, if you can send it over to me. That's great, and I appreciate that, but let me press you on that a little bit more. You are already making a difference, right? You are already making a difference in the military. You are already making a difference in strategy consulting. Why this way as opposed to working for a political action committee or just continuing what you were doing in the military or coming back on active duty for an amount of time? But why this specific way?
You know, I swore an oath to defend. I mean, I swore an oath to uphold and defend our Constitution. And the deep dysfunction of our politics threatens the ability for our government to carry on, for our Constitution to remain the amazing living document that it's been since at least the Constitution itself in 1789, right? And it is really that is if we can't get folks, I know my motivations. My motivations are to serve. My motivations are to leave a better country for our children and our grandchildren than the one that we have today. And if not me, and if not now, then who and then when is a good question. And I know the people of Virginia 10 will have no fiercer advocate for our values than me. And so how could I not do this?
Okay. I don't have any clever rejoinder to that. Look, I agree that absolutely somebody has to do it. And I thank you personally for bearing the cost that I think is unequal. And I must admit, from my own cost benefit calculation, I think, man, that's just an awful lot to ask my family to do. So personally and publicly, thank you for stepping out and trying to serve in this way rather than continuing to try to serve in other capacities. Which are perhaps a little bit, you know, it's easier to walk around and have people say thank you for your service when you're wearing your military uniform than it is when you're a congressman, where some people didn't even show up to 4th of July parades this year because our level of discourse has gotten so bad. So personally, thank you for that. Let's talk through a little bit more of the how. So you're a freshman in Congress. That's what we call all first term congressmen. It's not pejorative. It is what it is.
Better than being a plebe.
That's right. That's right. Absolutely. For the uninitiated, plebes are comes from the Latin plebeian, meaning the lowest of the low in Roman society. At the Citadel, where I went to school, we were knobs because we had all of our head completely shorn. They kept us the entire year without any hair, and we looked like doorknobs. So it is better than being a plebe. I get that. You're not going to have any major standing committee positions at this time. Nobody's going to put you at the head of Ways and Means or anything like that to start off with. Day one, you get in. Talk me through what is the trajectory for trying to make it a little bit better. I'm happy to talk at the tactical level or at kind of your longer term arc, whatever level you think is appropriate once you make it in day one.
Well, I imagine day one is still freshman orientation, right? So I'm still going to be getting told where my office is and where to go sit, right?
where the hideaway congressional pool is. I'll tell you, it's there. It's very nice.
I think tactically and practically, the first step is to getting to know as many of your fellow congresspeople and to letting them know that you're there to lead by listening, to understand perspective. And people will already know from your race. They'll know from my race, from the campaign that we're running here, how fierce an advocate I tend to be for our country and for our district. But as I've said a number of times, you can't do it alone. And it is about building bridges. And it's about building bridges to as many folks as you can in order to create the space and the opportunity to legislate effectively.
You are listening to How Do We Make It Better? Check us out at bit.ly/htwmib. That's bit.ly/htwmib. So I'm a fellow freshman congressman. Let's role play here from my home state, the great state of Wisconsin. And I'm very interested in building a bridge with you. And I think one of the important things that we all need to realize about the future of America is that we really collectively need to have dairy products that are of the quality that only Wisconsin can put out. And, you know, just a little bit of extra in the farm bill to help out farmers in my district would go a long way.
I think there's a lot of Virginia farmers. I think there's a lot of great Virginia farmers here that we're going to have to talk with and figure out how we broach that. We've got some great farms here in Virginia Tech. I'm looking forward to working with Wisconsin on figuring out how we can do this broadband. It's great.
But let's talk turkey here, Dan. We've got a farm bill that's coming up, and the good folks on the coast wanna pull out this provision that's been in there, a long-standing provision that's been helping farmers for the last 60 years. I just feel like it's unfair. Can I count on your help with that vote? It's what I came here to Congress on. And look, let's be practical, right? You live in Northern Virginia. It's a big military district. I happen to know that the great Marine Corps base in Quantico, Virginia is there. We got the Pentagon there. Look, there's plenty of extra things in the defense appropriations bill that we can make sure go your direction. How do you feel about just a simple this for that?
Well, it's day one, so I think we're going to need to get to day two before we make a deal. So let's chat in a couple of days. But it's really important. I agree that making sure that our farmers are well supported in this country is very important.
All right, love it, Dan. I'll be honest. I'm the representative from Wisconsin, and I'm not fully certain that our meeting was productive and successful. Right, like we're not being extraordinarily committal on these what end up being binary issues. Right, and stepping away from this kind of hokey scenario that I've put together. These kind of, as you put it a bit earlier, these polarizing issues become these partisan shibboleths where it's like, if you didn't vote this way in the farm bill, then clearly you are anti-ag. Or if you didn't vote this way on defense appropriation, then clearly, despite being a veteran, you're anti-military. Let's presume that you are going to have to cast a vote at some point. You can't always not show up for the roll call vote.
Oh, I won't show up for roll call votes. I think it's actually important to do that.
It's great. Let's presume that somebody takes your position and says, look, clearly what Dan is doing here is he doesn't care about farmers anyways because he voted this direction on this bill. How is your response to that going to be different than the simple hyper partisans that we can all agree currently exist in office?
Yeah, no, I think it is. It is a matter of saying, and who knows where this hypothetical is taking us in all sorts of directions. But let's just say straightforwardly that there is more in this bill if I vote against something that I dislike than I like. I don't think it's going to serve our country. I don't think it's going to serve the people of Virginia. But it doesn't mean that the people who put it together are in the wrong place. And so I think it's a matter of, do you vilify the folks who feel differently than you, or do you say, I disagree with this and I stand, on balance, I think there is more to dislike than like. Or if it's the other way and you're saying A, not nay, that it's more than I like than dislike. And there's some pieces that are wrong or wrongheaded, but on balance, it's sufficiently good that we can make do with this. And it's going to advance our cause as America. But I think it's, the biggest difference between the hyper-partisanship and the direction I'd like to see this go is a discussion on the merits and why you're making the decision and not about the evil of the other side.
Do you think that you can affect, I mean, it's great. It makes a lot of sense to me personally. Do you think that your voice is going to be able to rise above the din to VA-10? I mean, you're talking about relatively arcane components of relatively complicated bills and doing the kind of cost-benefit analysis that is, quote, wonkish, using your term. Do you think that you're going to easily be able to convey that to your electorate? And if so, how are you going to get cut through with the electorate to explain to them what you're continuing to do?
Yeah, I think our electorate is tired of being dumbed down to, I'll be honest. I think Americans are smart. We are a great people. And folks are dispirited with our politics because folks are talking down to them. And I believe you can have honest conversations about why you made this. And I think there are plenty of folks. I mean, I look at Seth Moulton, I look at Joe Kennedy. I look at Don Beyer here in Virginia. These are all folks who have done a very good job of talking about complicated things and making sure that electorates have a chance to understand them. And there's a bit of speaking simply about the complex. That's an art form. And there's a lot of it where you can find ways to make sure that people understand why you did it without having to go deep, deep into the weeds. And I think it's a bit of tone and it's a bit of respect. About respecting the American
people. Look, I appreciate where you're coming from. And one of the things that I did not personally enjoy about the presidential debates last time was that I felt like Hillary Clinton was trying to make oftentimes rather complicated arguments to the American public, getting a bit wonkish, talking about Article 5 of NATO and, you know, getting well down into the weeds and trying to convey complicated information to the American public. And they felt, I believe, like she was a bit professorial, right? And you've got a degree from Oxford to your name. I think you were a Rhodes Scholar there. You have the potential to have enough intellectual horsepower to really intimidate and not be able to connect with the average American voter. How, if you agree with that premise, and I'm happy for you to disagree with that premise, there were plenty of other things that went wrong in the Clinton campaign. How are you going to communicate complicated information to the American public without them feeling like you're talking down to them?
Yeah, but I would challenge it slightly. I think, you know, this campaign is a lot about listening. It's about hearing what folks have to say. And if the American people are heard, if the folks in Virginia 10 know that there is a representative who does represent. And represent is about hearing. It's about listening. It's not about always having. It's about taking the time to hear what's important to your constituent. It's about taking the complicated of so many different challenges faced by so many different people and weaving that into solutions that work not just for our district, but for our country more broadly.
Okay, I'm going to come at this from a slightly different direction because I really think it is, especially when you get elected, I'll speak in faith, you get challenged on an issue where you're on the back foot. Somebody says, they make a misrepresentation about a vote that you did, for instance. And you need to convey to your voters what you've done. Perhaps it wouldn't be dissimilar from being a platoon commander in the Army and somebody says, hey,
so now I know I'm talking to a Marine because we don't have platoon commanders.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, that's right. I'm sorry, platoon leaders in the Army. Apologies. So look, that works great as long as you're on the front foot continually. But occasionally, and I believe in you, but let's imagine you get on the back foot once. How do you convey to somebody who is already in this polarized position that you don't control all the media channels, right? That you do care about them and you haven't forgotten about them on, we'll take that silly example of the farm bill that we put together before, that you did care about them and you are thinking it through. Like, what is different about your approach than the very professorial approach? Or I guess I'm trying to draw through what makes Dan Helmer different.
Doug, I'm no politician. I'm going to tell the truth. If I'm asked why I did something differently, I'm going to tell folks why I did it. And I believe that people are ready to hear truth. People are ready to have someone who's honest with them. People are ready to have someone who's willing to problem solve. And I think that is going to be sufficient. I just think we overthink this. Tell the truth, do the right thing, represent the folks in this district well, and you can expect that people are going to understand that and be supportive.
Sometimes it doesn't get much more complicated than don't lie, cheat, or steal, or tolerate those who do, huh? That's the code that Dan would have signed up to the first day that he showed up at West Point, and I did that the first day I showed up at the Citadel as well. Okay. What is preventing you from, let's say that everybody's bought in on what you're doing and totally behind you. What can be done to help you fix it more rapidly, more holistically, more effectively? What are the obstacles that you're facing or that you've already run into in the campaign or that you anticipate running into that you want to get ahead of that are going to prevent you from effectively increasing this dialogue?
Well, you know what, Doug, I do got to get elected. So that's the first thing. And once we get past there, everything else can follow, right?
Very fair. Very fair. Okay. So, but if that is the big hurdle, then is it,
it's
people
not a
talk
hurdle.
A lot about money.
Right. It's the right one, right? I mean, we have,
no, that, that's true.
Right. It's,
no, that's
we,
fair.
We want the American people to have a shot at speaking, and we want to make sure that we are representative government. And the fact that we have elections is one of the things that is a hurdle. It's like a hurdle. I'm just saying, I got to get through there first.
That's very fair. Okay. So, well, let's talk about that most, well, let's call it a stage gate, shall we, to get very consultant on this. Look, so what is the biggest obstacle that you think you face presently to getting elected?
I think the obstacle I face is exactly the obstacle I should face. The goal is I need to make sure that I have an opportunity to talk to as many, they understand why I will be and how I will be such a fierce advocate for them in Washington.
Okay. So is the thing that's preventing you from doing it simply shoe leather? You know, you don't have enough shoes to go through to beat to down as many doors and knock on as many as you can in VA's 10th? Or is it you need to try and recruit more people for your ground game to do that? Is it advertising? Like what is preventing you from conveying that information to VA's 10th?
I would say that the only obstacle I have is time. We just started out here. we got a lot of time to go. We've got a lot of resources to put into the race, and we got to make sure that we have our, the only obstacle is us doing this well and making sure that we have a chance to talk to folks, folks understand what we're about, and we're going to do it. And so it's an obstacle in that, it's an obstacle only in that, you know, we just kicked off here in April. So we're going to be out there. We're going to be talking. We're going to be ever present. And we're going to be listening, and through listening and talking and making sure we meet as many folks as we can, we're going to have that opportunity to run an effective campaign, and we're going to have that opportunity to win. I'm very excited about it.
If somebody wants to help you along in some way, what is the best way for them to help you along? Is it respreading some of these talks that you're going to be giving, or listening sessions, or I don't want to put words in your mouth. What is it that others can do to help?
Yeah, look, Doug, we're starting a movement here. This is a movement to make sure our government works for the American people. And it matters here in Virginia 10, and it matters all over the country. I'd love to have as many folks that want to that can come and visit us, virtually or in person. So virtually, it's helmerforcongress.com. You should come and sign up and become part of what we're trying to do. And if you live here in the district, we are all over the district all the time. And love to meet you in person, and love to have folks out there spreading the word, helping us on getting what we're doing out there, helping us on the resource front. I think those are all important components. And the more folks that we have that are committed, not just to standing idly by while what happens to our government is happening, but actually get involved and be part of this movement to make sure our government is working for all Americans. I think the better we will do, the more effective we will be, and the greater progress we'll make into having a Congress that we look to and say, oh, man, I like the way that institution works.
Yeah, it would be amazing if the most respected institutions in America weren't consistently the courts, the Federal Reserve, and the military, the only unelected branches of government that we have. I think Congress bumbles away along at the very bottom of the most respected institutions that we have in America. Okay, specifically, if I could drill in on just the involvement component once more with you, is there some specific way that people who are not in your district could get involved that would be useful or interesting for you personally?
Absolutely. Look, follow us on social media. Get the word out there. Certainly get the word out to people within the district. You know, there are candidates here in Virginia, and we have a race here in Virginia in 2017, making sure we get a great governor elected, a great new House of Delegates candidates elected. That's going to be absolutely critical to ensuring that we have the conditions at the state level and subsequently at the national level to restoring trust in our government.
Great. I think time for us, we're quickly drawing to a close on this interview, to jump into a few quick rapid fire questions for you. What, if you were going to define them, would be your strengths?
I'm a leader, I'm a problem solver, and I'm a patriot. And those things will allow me to be an effective legislator.
Okay. Great. Next question. What are you learning right now?
I'm learning how sore your arm can get after holding up a phone for 12 hours.
You poor man. Yet another unseen casualty of running for Congress. Unfortunately, well, good for you. I can tell you that when I spent time in there, and I don't think most Americans appreciate this, the average congressman flies in to Washington, D.C. on Tuesday morning and flies out on Thursday night. And the rest of the time, they're spending back in their district, shaking hands, talking to people. That's okay if you, you know, are in Virginia, but that is truly hell if you are in California or Hawaii or Alaska. And look, spare a bit of a thought for what these guys are putting their families through and the work that they have to go through to actually legislate. It's not an easy job. And unfortunately, Dan, as you know, right, this is just the beginning, as you said. What have you read or who have you met or what would you like to share with the audience that you found was helpful for you? If people are bought into what you're saying, then where else could they go to find what Dan is reading?
Yeah, reading we can hit in a second, but you know the other side of the coin on the 12, you know, all joking aside, on the arm getting sore after 12 hours on the phone or shaking hands or all the other things that were today, you do have the opportunity to meet, to hear amazing stories and to learn so much about what makes Virginia 10 and our country more broadly tick. And it is such an honor and such an amazing experience to meet all of these folks who want a better country for themselves and for their children and for their grandchildren. And I've just learned so much from doing that and having this opportunity to campaign and seek to represent. So more than anything else, I mean, I do read. I have a whole bunch of books sitting by the nightside table right now, and less read than I would have liked them to be at times. But you know, whether it's reading the newspaper every day or reading the book, I think it is the ability to meet people and hear their stories that sets this experience apart.
That's great. If you were to commend anything to anybody who's listening that you thought was really important to you, is there one or two titles or speeches or anything that I can link to in the show notes that other people might be interested in seeing? I've already got down, you know, Helmer for Congress and newpolitics.org. Is there anything else that you'd commend to people who are listening?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I honestly, I'm a student of history. I think that if folks are interested in this time in our country, I think looking at Cicero, actually, if you want to go back in time and looking about what he was talking about in a particularly bad period in the Roman Republic, is a great, great place to look. And, you know, I also find that the biographies of some of our founders are tremendous. So there are any number of places to start there. So if going for the long read, those are good places. I think they put that out there.
Okay, sounds great. If you do think of something else after we're done, I will post those links in the show notes and anybody else can try and read what Dan is reading. Final question for you. What should I have asked you that I did not?
Oh, by the way, what I'm reading right now, Al Franken's book is really funny, which is what's on my nightside today.
Okay, I'll make sure I put that in the show notes.
Yeah.
To round it out, I really just want to give you an opportunity to say, what is it you'd like to say? This might be one of the few and fleeting opportunities that that congressmen get to say what they want to say, unedited and just sent out into the world. And the form of this is a question, as seems to be so appropriate for a man like yourself who likes asking questions. What should I have asked you that I didn't? And then maybe if you could just roll into answering your own question, then I'd love to hear your response to yourself.
I would ask, and you've asked a version of this, but it says, why can this campaign win? And the answer to that is that as I've gone across the district, I've met so many people who are tired of politics that are failing. And there is a mass of people, regardless of party, who are ready to do something different. We're ready for folks who come from outside of the political system. We're going to come into government. We're going to lead. We're going to listen. And we're going to try to problem solve and deliver new solutions that work for all. And by speaking that truth, and by getting the word out there about what we're doing, we're going to be able to win. And we're going to be able to win not just a difficult Democratic primary that we have coming up, but also in the general election against Barbara.
What a great note to end on. Dan, I just want to thank you for taking yet more of your already precious time to talk to me. Links to all the things that Dan talked about are going to be in the show notes. And again, just thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you so much, Doug. It's my pleasure. And I really appreciate your doing this. You're taking the time. Absolutely important that we have folks who are sitting down and talking. And the more democratize our media, have folks like you who are taking an interest and spreading the word, the more successful we're going to be as a country.
Great. So we've reached the end of this interview. And Dan is probably the first politician in recent memory to not tell you what party he represents. So that falls to me. I ask that you reflect on how you deal with the information I'm about to present to you. Does it make you feel worse about a person who you were otherwise listening to? Does it make you feel better about them? Because the truth is, what I'm about to tell you actually has no bearing on Dan. What he told you is what he told you, and how you feel about it is how he should have made you feel about it. The information I'm about to give you shouldn't affect your opinion one way or another. But we know empirically that it does. And if I were to tell you in advance of this episode what political party he was with, well, then most people would find ways to either pick apart or embrace what he's saying. So I ask you to, at least in this regard, listen to Dan. He talked a lot about method and about civil conversations, listening to people with other points of view. I personally am going to take up the challenge that he has given in that regard, and I hope that you do too. But his party affiliation is, in fact, that of a Democrat. He is running against Barbara Comstock in Virginia's 10th congressional district, and he has a tough fight ahead of him. Historically, in non-presidential congressional years, that district has swung very hard to the Republican side. I very much suspect that with his background, had he merely badged himself as a Republican and been able to run, he would have been very successful in that district. I hope that you consider Dan as the person rather than Dan as the Democrat. And I hope that after listening to this, you take up his challenge to reach out a bit more and to support more conversations like the ones that he's hoping to fulfill. And Dan, just personal message for me, my hat's off to you for trying. We need more people to sacrifice a lot of their own personal time, energy, effort, and money to try and make it better. And thank you for doing that. You are listening to How Do We Make It Better? Check us out at bit.ly/HDWMIB. That's bit.ly/HDWMIB. I could not do these without the dedicated professionals at Sound4U in South Africa. They are behind the music and the mix and everything else that goes into making this podcast actually happen. They go above and beyond in every way, turning a simple recording into a true production. Thanks again.